On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You might not guess it from the Made in China tags that seem to be on everything these days. But even now, in the era of offshoring jobs and hyper-competition, the good old USA does still know how to manufacture at home and sell abroad. Last year saw the biggest jump in U.S. exports since 1988. But the future of jobs and wages and trade is still a wide-open question. Today we'll go to Caterpillar and John Deere and high-tech Palo Alto to see how successful exporters do it, and we'll ask economists if we can keep it up. Up next on Point, still made in the USA. We're going to go today to Caterpillar and John Deere in the Midwest and to a high-tech exporter in California. But joining me first in the studio is Andrew Bernard, professor of international economics at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. He's bullish on American manufacturing and its export future. Andrew Bernard, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All kinds of numbers out there. Some look promising, some don't. How do you see the future for American manufacturers right now? It's easy to get the impression, you know, that the days of a Made in USA label around the world are waning.
That's true. In fact, the death of manufacturing has been predicted more times than just about any other industry. I like to say that it's read its obituary more times than Mark Twain did. But in each case, manufacturing is able to come back. It comes back a little bit different, a little reorganized in different sectors, sectors we didn't necessarily predict. And we're in the middle of one of those upticks right now.
An uptick, why? We've got a cheaper dollar. It slumped a little bit last year. Is that the reason? We've just become more competitive in pricing terms? Or are we learning something about how to take on China, India, you name it?
I think it's a bit of both, and I think it's partly that the dollar is helping out U.S. manufacturers right now, but that's maybe a small part. I think what's really been driving it is the fact that the domestic economy has been good. And when things are good at home, then firms can expand, and that's when they look to take advantage of foreign markets as well.
I'm looking here at numbers from 2006. Pretty impressive. Exports of U.S. goods up 14.5% last year. Imports up just 10.9%, though that's a lot, too. First time since 1997 that exports rose more rapidly than imports. The biggest rise in exports since 1988. So the dollar's part of this. Oil figures in here, too, I guess, in when it comes to the balance of trade. But what about, you know, in the factory? I mean, who still makes it happen in this country? Consumers see consumer products, and those seem to come overwhelmingly from China. What's out there that works?
Well, I think what the United States is really focused on is less on consumer products and more on large industrial products, very high-tech, very capital-intensive, very knowledge-intensive products. And that's where you see the real strength. You know, you talk about the Caterpillars of the world. They're not building something typically you're going to drive in your backyard. When you go to shop for Christmas, all you see is made in China, made in Taiwan, and you get the impression that that's where all the production in the world is. The United States is the number one manufacturing company in the world,
country
in the world. And we tend to lose sight of that. We tend to never talk about that. And we have been number one for a while. And I don't think being number one is good by itself, but it does give you an indication that there's a lot going on here.
We had exports topping $1 trillion last year, I believe, for the first time. And you're expressing optimism about that. We're going to hear later in this hour from an economist with a very different view, saying we're getting slaughtered in sector after sector at home. And if we can't compete at home, how do we compete abroad? I'm looking down here at the biggest categories of U.S. exports, merchandise exports, nuclear reactors and boilers, nuclear stuff. Number one, 17.6% of U.S. exports, then electrical machinery, vehicles, aircraft, spacecraft, right down to optics and plastics, gets down to like 4%. So that's a range of big, what kind of infrastructure equipment in no small part that people are selling.
That's right. Those tend to show up on top when you have a good year selling nuclear reactors. They're very expensive. They come out on top. What's in that mix, of course, are things like instruments and measurement equipment, something that the average person doesn't really deal with unless, I guess, they go to the dentist's office, but it's critical for manufacturing around the world, and we are a net exporter in those sectors.
Manufacturing has taken it on the chin for a long time. In the 80s, there was an uproar about it, lots of worry then.
And then there was the thought, was, well, we'll succeed on services. Then along comes the internet, and services start going overseas. Alan Blinder making a big noise this week, the Wall Street Journal reporting how he's saying, you know, we could lose 30 to 40 million jobs. Anything you can send service-wise over an internet wire is going to go. Computer programmers, film and video editors, medical transcriptionists going abroad, accounting, bookkeeping, microbiologists, financial analysts. And suddenly we're looking back at American factories and saying, wait a minute, maybe the services will slide out of town more easily than manufacturing. Can manufacturing pick up the slack?
I'm not sure it's reasonable to think that manufacturing is going to pick up the slack, but I think that we want to frame the vision of the future a little differently. There are 30 to 40 million jobs if you take Blinder's account, and I have colleagues, Brad Jensen at the Peterson Institute, who has a slightly smaller figure. Those are jobs at risk. Let's go back in time and think about the apparel and textile sector, a sector that's really not a huge sector anymore in the United States. Mm-hmm. There are still apparel and textile producers in the U.S. They're exporting producers. They're high-end. It didn't go completely away. So even a sector where we really sort of say, okay, it's all done and over, we've still got production, and production that's not going to disappear. Because
so you're saying the same thing will happen in services, or that we've got a sticky quality to the manufacturing?
When you talk about 30 to 40 million jobs at risk, it's not that they're all disappearing. It's that some of them will be moved overseas, and some other types of jobs will grow. And so I think it's a bit disingenuous to say, look, we've got 30 million jobs. They're all going to run away. They're not all going to run away. Some of them, some activities will be relocated overseas. There's no doubt about that. And firms are trying to figure out how to take advantage of that.
And many of them are doing it well into that already.
Exactly. And others are going to be increased. There's going to be more activity at home in other jobs. And so that's what we've seen in manufacturing. Manufacturing employment has fallen. Manufacturing output has not. There's been a shift toward the service sector of the economy. Tradable services will follow a path like manufacturing. There's no doubt about it. We're much earlier in the game, but there is going to be a reallocation across activities. That's what trade really is all about.
But you can't blame Americans for wondering what's going to be left to build. We want to talk with some manufacturers who are doing it and succeeding at it today to try and see what we can learn there. I want to go first to Peoria, Illinois, to Jonathan Aull. He's news director there at WCBU Radio. He's been covering equipment maker Caterpillar for a decade or so. Jonathan Aull, thanks a lot for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
So there you are, sitting on a company that's just going like gangbusters, world's number one maker of earth-moving machinery, and it's got a lot of ag equipment, headed toward $50 billion in sales, $10 billion in exports from the United States. How do they do it? Why doesn't China outcompete Caterpillar, Jonathan?
There's no one answer to this. I think that whenever there's an issue like this, people are always looking for that one magic bullet, and there isn't. Caterpillar and other successful manufacturers have really done dozens of things, and if you look at Caterpillar specifically, there's many different things that they've done, but one of the things that I think is the biggest issue is the focus that they've had on long-term vision for what the company is going to do and how they're going to do it. You mentioned the 1980s and the big sell-off that everybody had in manufacturing.
Yeah.
Well, Caterpillar's response to that was, how are we going to be competitive 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years from now? They did a lot of things like investing in R&D, and not just R&D in products, but also in process. How are they making things? How are they transferring them to other places? What is their logistics setup? I mean, so much so that Caterpillar even has a logistics business now. They spent so much time trying to improve their own logistics that they're now doing logistics for other people.
They basically doubled their revenues in the past, couple of 3 years.
Yeah, they went from, they had this long-term goal of getting to a $30 billion company, and they made it 3 or 4 years ahead of schedule. Now they're talking about $50 billion. So not only did they increase dramatically over the last 5 years or so, but they're anticipating that growth to continue.
Now, here's a company where globalization, a hot global economy, has been very helpful for them, selling a lot into Asia, into Central Asia, Latin America. Any place where economies are taking off, the big earth movers show up to help make that happen. 278 factories, 94,000 employees. But Cat is already building abroad as well. What's the future look like, Jonathan? From sitting in Peoria, are workers there confident that Caterpillar's success will continue to be their success, their paycheck at home in the U.S.?
Well, anytime you have a company town, there's always going to be those people who like to rage against the machine and will say that they're very, very concerned and they're very worried. Certainly the last union contract, even though it was ratified by the membership, a lot of people had some concerns in it. It had a two-tier wage structure. There's some concerns along those lines.
Two tiers to try and keep the wages down where they might compete with foreign manufacturers, maybe Chinese one day?
No, it's really more about cost containment. I think that maybe it's difficult to separate that, but it's about cost containment and about, you know, supply and demand. What will workers be able to do and what price will they be willing to do it for? So there's a two-tier wage structure. But, you know, the bottom line is that Caterpillar has increased its domestic workforce, both white-collar and blue-collar, in recent years. They say they have a strong commitment to a large North American manufacturing base. The local community college here has set up a tech training program specifically geared towards training people to be in high-tech manufacturing. Now, they don't specifically say it's just for Caterpillar,
but Caterpillar has
a lot of and they have a lot of very older employees that are doing a lot of high-tech things right now, and a lot of them are going to retire in the next 10 years, and Caterpillar is trying to be proactive to make sure that there are going to be people who are able to move into those jobs.
Right now, joining us from Waterloo, Iowa, Timothy Hurley. He's mayor of Waterloo since 2004, where John Deere employs more than 5,000 people. Before he became mayor, he was for 37 years at John Deere, retiring as a manager of materials engineering in the company's Waterloo Product Engineering Center. Timothy Hurley, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you.
It's great to have you. It's wonderful to have you. Here we're looking at these numbers from last year. American exports up 12.7%. In 2006. That sounds kind of like music to our ears, an unfamiliar sound there. John Deere did very well selling tractors overseas. And you know, these days, Tim Hurley, that sounds like Kohl's to Newcastle. How does John Deere sell tractors in a time when China's got increasing manufacturing, very low wages? How does John Deere do it? Build them here and sell them there?
A lesson learned. You know, I think, Tom, when I first started with the company 40 years ago, we were basically a North American company. And we suffered the vicissitudes of the market, you know, the cyclicality of it in North America. And we began looking at what else we could do in terms of broadening our product line and also our market. And we got into Europe, first of all, and now we're literally all the way around the world. And you know, when I was talking with your producer, we were talking about technology and Deere is no different than Cat. I mean, you know, we don't have an exclusive to technology or to capital or to materials such as steel or paints or anything like that. I think the real secret that at least for the success of Deere has been their reawakened focus on the customer, their devotion to the customer, and that turns around. That's a two-way street. You now see generational, multi-generational fidelity to Deere, and that's a real franchise.
But we've seen customer loyalty crack up before when the price competition gets too severe. You mentioned Deere's sales to China, but then I'm just looking at this new headline, Tim Hurley, saying China has now displaced, U.S. sales to Europe. And here it says China has now displaced the U.S. as the largest source of European Union imports as of 2006. So I'm still thinking to myself, all right, and granted, Deere's making lots of tractors around the world now in factories elsewhere, but there's still something they're making here that's going abroad. What is it? Is that the high end of their product line that's in the States?
It's the flagship. The Waterloo product are the largest of the tractors they make, just like, you know, you have a guest on from Peoria, and they're certainly doing great things down there with the larger industrial equipment, and the largest ag equipment is made here in Waterloo, and has been for 70 years.
They're selling high-tech tractors equipped with satellite tracking technology.
Absolutely.
Exporting to China, India, Central Europe, former Soviet Republic in Central Asia. You're Dave Everett, who's president of North America and more there of Deere & Company, quoted saying, there are more lines of computer code in these tractors than there is in the space shuttle. But I hear you saying, Tim Hurley, that you're not confident you'll compete on technology alone over the long haul. It's got to be that relationship.
I think that's, again, our success recently might give us some buying power and maybe get it first or whatever, but technology alone is something that you just need to keep up with. It's one of those arrows in your quiver. I think, at least in my experience, when I left the company, I was very confident that they were getting it right, and they were getting it right around the world, and it came from the top, from the CEO and the executive staff, and that was an unflagging, undaunted focus on the customer and doing right for the customer. And I don't care if you're farming in Europe or Africa or Australia or China, you are ultimately going to be concerned about productivity, about reliability of your equipment, and about service to that equipment.
Andrew Bernard, here we are hearing from Mayor Hurley in Waterloo, Iowa, John Deere Country, Jonathan All in Peoria, Caterpillar Country. They've both got success stories right now. But we've seen the big three automakers in terrible trouble. We see an awful lot of manufactured goods and high-end stuff increasingly coming into this country. What do we learn from these two stories, Deere and Caterpillar, and does it last? Does it go forward? Can it be emulated?
Well, I think there are aspects of this that can be emulated, and I think, you know, I'd like to think that John Deere's success is because it's run largely by graduates of the Tuck School, but I don't think that's actually hey. What's driving it. Both these companies in the not-too-distant past looked out at the world. They reduced their focus on their navel, so to speak, and they decided to look around the world and see what was happening. Where was the competition going to come from? Where were the markets of the future? What were the products of the future? And that kind of long-run planning has now fed down into a successful production facility in each of these towns and elsewhere in the U.S., and not only in the U.S. And we have to realize these are big multinationals.
Sure.
And multinationals, I mean, there was a comment by Jonathan All that Caterpillar's increased its U.S. workforce. Actually, multinationals operating in the U.S., U.S. multinationals, have grown their labor in the U.S. faster than the rest of the economy. So they are a driving force of job growth. And it's because they're engaged in all these markets around the world. There are obviously failures among them, but these companies are combining what's best about the United States: flexibility, long-run planning, an educated workforce that can change, technology, access to capital, and a vision for what their product should be. It's very specific to theirs. They're not trying to beat the world at everything.
Jonathan, Mayor Hurley, let me ask each of you, and then I know I've got to let you go, but first, Jonathan All, sitting there in Peoria, Caterpillar Country, what's the sense of the town? Look a decade ahead. Is there confidence that you can hang on to this big giant and its jobs here in the U.S. exporting abroad?
I believe so. I really do, because remember, it's not just about Caterpillar. As a matter of fact, people here are feeling very good about the local economy because Caterpillar has been growing, but they're not the only ones that are growing. Caterpillar also casts a long shadow that people are benefiting from. There are other manufacturers in the Peoria area that are exporting 50, 60, 70% of what they make here in the Peoria area. And having Caterpillar in their backyard and having expertise in the area, be it academic or specifically at Caterpillar, has really helped other manufacturers find their niche. They're learning by watching Caterpillar. They're learning that you can be successful in a global marketplace, but you have to be flexible. You have to, the one thing that Caterpillar has said that I think is revolutionary is they really changed the focus to build what they sell, not selling what they build. The idea of just-in-time delivery of product has been huge, not just for Caterpillar, but for other manufacturers where, you know, they're really focusing more on what does the customer want right now and how do we get it to them right now, be it made in Peoria or Lafayette, Indiana, or in Brazil or in China. How do they use all of their resources around the world to serve the customers that want stuff now? And I think that's the attitude that has really made them. They're kind of like a nimble battleship, if that makes any sense, that they're huge, but they really are trying to focus on trying to be as flexible and nimble as they can. And they do that by having diverse markets. I mean, diversity of markets is huge. Europe can go into a three-year slump, but Caterpillar isn't hurting because Asia might be buying more and South America might be buying more. And then North America will go into a slump, but then Europe comes back.
Somewhere else to pick up the slack. But there's
exactly.
A note of confidence in CAT, in Peoria. Mayor Hurley, how about you and John Deere looking ahead? I mean, we've seen a lot of American manufacturing hit the skids. What's your confidence level looking forward?
My confidence level has never been higher, and it's partly the job I've got now and my relationship, you know, over 30 years with Deere. Deere just invested. They're still the largest employer in Waterloo at maybe 5,000 or 6,000. 20 years ago, it was 16,500 employed here. But they just invested $125-130 million in new manufacturing technology here in Waterloo, and turned around and donated 40 buildings and several hundreds of thousands of square feet back to a nonprofit that will be turned into Technology Works, which will do bio-based application research. Now, that comes full circle, because if you can make plastic skin panels out of soybean resins that are planted and harvested by Deere tractors,
that's
full circle. And that's what we'll be doing here, and that's the sort of partnership. Our local economy is much more diverse than it was back in those 16,500 employee days. And that's good, because I don't think Deere necessarily enjoyed being the heart of the city, although they certainly are. Mm.
So far so good, kind of a fairly robustly positive view of the future there, Mayor Hurley.
I'm very robust. I feel very strong about it, particularly here in Waterloo.
We're going to hear from another economist view of what's going on right now, but I want to thank each of you, Mayor Timothy Hurley in Waterloo, Iowa. Thanks for the frontline report on your old employer there, John Deere.
You bet. Tom, thank you. It's an honor.
It's great to have you. And Jonathan All, news director at WCBU Radio in Peoria, Illinois, where Caterpillar reigns. Jonathan All, thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Let me turn now to Washington and economist Alan Tonelson. He's a research fellow at the U.S. Business and Industry Council. They advocate for American manufacturers. They've opposed NAFTA. He's author of Race to the Bottom, Why a Worldwide Worker Surplus and Uncontrolled Free Trade are Sinking American Living Standards. Alan Tonelson, thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We've heard a pretty rosy view of the prospects for American manufacturing and manufacturing exports right now. Yours is not so rosy. Why? What do you see out there?
Well, let's start with the story that we just heard about Caterpillar, which absolutely flabbergasted me, because that company's labor policies were only touched on very briefly at the very end of this report.
Yeah, we heard just
no
a touch there. Yep.
What no one heard was that a key element to Caterpillar's drive to maintain competitiveness was crushing and killing its union and driving the wages of its production workers down to the bone. Now, you don't have to be a great humanitarian or a great advocate of labor unions to understand that what might be very good for the profitability of one company or many companies is a disastrous formula for the American economy.
When you say down to the bone, what do you mean, Alan Tonelson, in terms of cat wages?
Much lower than they were.
And what
we've seen is multinational companies in particular throughout manufacturing, and it's going to happen in services now to all of those jobs that you just mentioned that are at risk. The way that the jobs will be kept in this country to provide employment for our citizens is by driving them down by multinationals essentially threatening to go overseas if U.S. workers don't accept much lower pay and many fewer benefits.
So there's,
and Caterpillar has been the lead here. They're the state of the art.
There's a tough view the other side of the coin right there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Andrew Bernard, that's just the beginning of Alan Tonelson's critique here, but he says, look, okay, they hang on to their jobs, but they've done it by crushing unions and wages.
Well, and there's no doubt that there are sectors where wages are falling, in particular sectors like furniture, which are facing huge amounts of imports. Wages are dropping because the wage that they're competing with is quite a bit lower in China. That's not the overall picture of the economy, though. We have an economy where there has been wage growth for on average, and when you look inside, then you see widening wage inequality. So folks in sort of the bottom 40% haven't been doing that well.
So doesn't that support that this is the economic story nationally?
But the Caterpillar workers weren't in the bottom 40% to begin with, and they're probably not in the bottom 40% now. So that's not really that group that we're talking about.
But are they headed? I guess there's the question. If maybe the U.S. can compete, maybe, But is it going to require such a cut in the standard of living to do that, that it's kind of Pyrrhic victory? Yes, we're still exporting, but no, we're not living like our parents did in those manufacturing jobs.
That's not what I see when I look at the manufacturing data. The real issue in manufacturing has been counting jobs. When you count jobs, you see manufacturing jobs declining. And that's been viewed as the sort of bellwether that the manufacturing sector is going away. Wages, on average, in the manufacturing sector have been rising, and they have been rising because productivity has been going up.
I really need to,
Alan, please,
to break in here because I don't know what Professor Bernard is talking about. If you look at manufacturing wages adjusted for inflation, which is what you have to do, what any responsible economist will actually do, you find that they peaked in the late 1970s. Since then, they have gone absolutely nowhere. For the 2.5 decades before that, after World War II, they were rising continually in real terms. They have gone absolutely nowhere for manufacturing as a whole since about 1978 for many manufacturing industries, including many advanced manufacturing industries. They've gone down.
And you report
you
as
have
well.
To look at You have to look at trends over time. You can't look at snapshots.
Of course, we've got the report out today saying, I guess this is from 2005, the top 1% of Americans receiving the largest share of national income since 1928. The top 300,000 Americans collectively raking in almost as much income as the bottom 150 million Americans. That's kind of head-turning. You report, Alan Tonelson, that in 110 of 114 key U.S.-based industries, American industries are losing domestic share to foreign goods.
That's exactly right, Tom. And this is the most compelling evidence we have that U.S. manufacturing is being hollowed out. And the reason is that the U.S. market is the world's largest single national market. It is the market of last resort for every other major trading power in the world. It's the most technologically demanding market. And it's the market that U.S.-based producers should know best. After all, they live here. And it's the market where they face no trade barriers. And you see in industry after industry, including virtually every high-tech, high-value industry you can think of, U.S.-based manufacturers are losing out to foreign competition. And just think of it. Just think of any single company going to a Wall Street investment banker and saying, you know, I'm losing market share, but I'm really doing great, and you should give me more money, you should, you know, buy my stock. They would be laughed out of that office, and rightly so.
I've been joined by Alan Tonelson. He's a research fellow at the U.S. Business and Industry Council in Washington. Andrew Bernard is with me in the studio. He's professor of international economics at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. He's bullish on trade. Alan, as you hear, not so. Let's go to our listeners and see what they find out there. Andy's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I have 3 points I just want to bring up to you and your guest today, the topics of innovation, collaboration, and adaptive reuse. And what I quickly mean by that is there's an interesting phenomenon going on in Rhode Island that I don't know is playing out in the rest of the country, and I'd like to hear what your guests have to say about it. One, in the area of innovation when it comes to manufacturing, that there are companies around the country, there's actually one in Rhode Island itself, Concordia Fibers, that is taking old-line textile manufacturing, retooling that technology, training their staff, getting ISO certifications, and lo and behold, they can use their spinning technologies that were used once for North Face and other textile manufacturing contracts, now for biomedical devices.
So that's innovation and adaptive reuse all in one.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is Rhode Island, like a lot of other states, particularly in the Northeast Corridor, have this abundance of old mill space. And what we're seeing now is that, at least here in Rhode Island, that developers are coming in and creating new space, incubator space, for 21st century companies, particularly in the area of digital IT and other sectors as well. And I don't know if that's a trend that's happening nationally. I'd like to hear from your guests whether or not they see that happening in other parts of the country.
Andy, we'll look at it. We're going to hear from some real greenfield work in California, Palo Alto, in just a minute as well. Let me hold that thought on adaptive reuse. Get another call here from Little River, South Carolina. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm not a economist or I'm not a corporate worker or anything like that. I'm a retired air traffic controller.
Okay. What have you seen?
Well, I've seen the industrial base of the USA decline considerably since I was born, and I attribute it to many things. The greatest, of course, is greed. Keep the stockholder happy. And the other one that specifically is the waiver of our import fees for foreign goods.
You're talking free trade agreements that have that became so popular in the 90s. You're hearing the same as we are today, Bob. Caterpillar, John Deere, and more coming, that they're doing just fine. Do you think it can be turned around?
I don't. I would like to be able to say yes, but until such time as we start emphasizing the importance of the majority of the people in this country and not emphasize the importance of corporations, I don't think it'll be turned around.
That's a tough one in our economy, but we hear it. Bob, thanks for your call. Let me pick. There's a lot right there already on the table. Let's start with the plant that we've got. I mean, we've got a lot of infrastructure in this country, not all of it in the greatest shape, some of it old now, but we heard from Rhode Island it can be turned into an advantage looking forward. Andrew Bernard, do you agree, or is it an albatross?
Yeah, I think one of the things that people would be surprised to hear is something along the following lines. If you look around today at the manufacturing facilities, 30% of the manufacturing facilities today were not in existence 5 years ago.
So that's brand new stuff.
Brand new stuff. Now, that could be someone who's gone into an old building, but the flip side is that if you look around today, 30% of the folks who are in manufacturing facilities today will be gone 5 years from now. I mean, the U.S. economy and the manufacturing sector is amazingly adaptive and flexible.
But does our legacy help us? If it's green field, I mean, China can build on a green field too.
Well, that's where I thought that Andy's call actually was quite elucidating, because it's taking some of the knowledge that we have in one area and applying it into a new area, a new growth area. That tends to be a very successful method for startup manufacturers to get the skills and the people, they get some of the machinery, and they get a new market and a new product. And that's a very nice way to enter new markets. Now, what's happening overall? I think that the notion that the U.S. manufacturing sector has gone away is just incorrect. The share of output, the share of GDP, stuff produced in the United States that's attributable to manufacturing, is the same today as it was in the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1970s and the 1980s and the 1990s. That share is about 15%, and it really hasn't changed. And the Cleveland Fed and others have done work showing this. This is an old fact that many of us know. The share of employment in manufacturing has dropped precipitously from that point. So we started at about 30% in the early 1950s, and we're down to around 12% of employment in manufacturing today. The thing that drove that was productivity growth. Productivity growth in manufacturing has been outpacing the economy as a whole,
right,
and allows us to make more stuff with fewer people.
Let me pivot right on that point, if I may, and come to you, Alan. Our caller, Bob, in South Carolina, he says, too much greed, too much, in his view, free trade. Andrew Bernard points out that productivity has grown a lot, and so you can still have manufacturing but fewer jobs. Does that translate to a net good for the American workforce?
I'm very glad that we are talking about productivity, because Professor Bernard doesn't seem to be aware of the fact that the folks in the U.S. government who actually calculate the real productivity figures that we all see each month and each year, etc., have acknowledged on the record before members of Congress that the methods that they use result in offshoring work and offshoring jobs, producing gains in U.S. productivity. So what these productivity numbers are really showing us is not necessarily that U.S.-based manufacturers can make more stuff with many fewer workers in many cases, and we don't know exactly how many yet, and we need to look into this very urgently, but in many cases, possibly most cases, what it shows is that U.S.-based manufacturers can make more stuff with fewer U.S. workers, but transferring many jobs overseas.
Are you saying throw up trade barriers then, or stop liberalizing trade?
Well, certainly we need to take stock as a nation of where we are. We have to stop this unprecedented bleeding, which is not only threatening our manufacturing base, which is indeed still very large because for 230 years we did such a good job of building up manufacturing. And it's going to take a long time to see that vanish. There's no question about it. But all the trends are pointing exactly the wrong way. And to stanch this bleeding, which is not only manufacturing related, it is threatening the nation's financial future as well. We need to stop and take stock and figure out how to do trade policy right, how to turn U.S. trade policy into an engine not of offshoring, which it is in way too many cases now, but of expanding production at home. And we are a long way from that point right now.
I want to go out to the cutting-edge frontier of technology to see what we can find there. We're turning to Palo Alto, California. We're joined from Palo Alto by Timothy Guertin. He's president and CEO of Varian Medical Systems, $1.8 billion company, not on the scale of Caterpillar or Deer, but big and growing. They manufacture systems for radiation therapy and X-ray imaging, 4,000 employees around the world, major manufacturing in Palo Alto and in Salt Lake City. He also happens to be chairman of the American Electronics Association. Tim Guertin, thanks very much for being here.
Hello, Tom. I'm glad to be with you.
So your company has got very high-tech equipment, and it's doing well on exports. Do you see yourself as a model for the future? What's your confidence for the country overall on manufacturing exports?
Well, you know, we're probably a model for some kinds of businesses, that's for sure. You know, the secret to doing well internationally and to exporting a lot is to have winning products that and winning service that people want to buy internationally, and to know your customers really well in those local markets. And medical devices are an example where people really value high-end products. Nobody wants to treat patients with equipment that's second-rate or provide them with medical treatments that aren't up to par. I think this is one of America's great strengths. It's actually as a provider of healthcare products, both in the high-tech medical device area and in the pharmaceutical area. I think this is one of America's strengths. So this has worked out well for us. It's an area where we're able to provide products that people really want.
What are big markets for you abroad, Tim Guertin?
Well, we do a lot of business in Europe and in Asia, and we're seeing increased business in Latin America, Australia, so really all over the world. And, of course, our business in North America has been growing as well.
Are you afraid that China, India may climb up the ladder and sort of bite you from the rear, catch up with you technologically, do it at a lower cost, and ace you out?
Well, you know, we've been competing with some companies, for example, in China for quite a while. I would see documents that would show pictures of machines that looked remarkably like our machines and for sale in China. What we've been able to do, however, is provide very high-end technology that really is at the state of the art for medical care. And so when we're talking to physicians in China, you know, they want to know if you're a leading manufacturer in the world, and they want to know where the leading edge is. And if you're the leading manufacturer and you have the leading edge, and if they can access the money, then we're the people who they buy from.
Then look a little more broadly. You're chairman of the American Electronics Association. Not everybody is on the bleeding cutting edge of technology. I mean, does your model work for large scale? Can it, you know, across the electronics industry, can you keep a lot of Americans employed in manufacturing at good wages, or is it just a sort of high-tech fringe that doesn't spread that far?
Well, certainly high tech is one of the areas where I think we can boost manufacturing. And I think one of your speakers said earlier, maybe not every area in the economy is going to benefit equally from competition abroad. But I think high tech and healthcare are examples of areas where we can boost our manufacturing presence and where we can do really well. Now, it is going to require that we educate people, that we have lots of people get into the sciences, study mathematics. We need to build America's brain trust, because when the people are here, when the leaders are here, they want to manufacture here. They want the people who work for them to be in the United States as much as they can be. And I think it's to the benefit of all of us that happened.
So there's a hopeful outlook from Palo Alto. A little cutaway here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me take a call from Tupper Lake, New York. Stuart, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is actually for all your guests. I'd like to get their point of view from their perspectives. What can the average American consumer do? And I'm talking lower and middle class, you know, that type of consumer.
Okay, yeah.
What can we do as a majority of people to kind of swing the pendulum more in our favor so far as keeping more jobs here, motivating companies to kind of not so much go overseas, but stay here and export more.
Stuart, thanks a lot. Alan Tunnelson, let me put it to you. Ordinary citizens who are worried about this, concerned, want U.S. manufacturing exports, manufacturing to be strong, what can they do?
The most effective thing that they can do is tell their members of Congress that they are sick and tired of the offshoring-focused trade policies that our country has been pursuing for 20 years now, and they want major change.
What are you pointing to when you say offshoring-focused trade policy?
NAFTA. All of our trade expansion with China. In fact, if you look at those countries and regions that have been targeted by a U.S. trade policy since the late 1980s, early 1990s, they're, strangely enough, they're overwhelmingly very low-income countries.
But I'm looking here at an interview with Jim Owens, who's the CEO of Caterpillar, where we heard from earlier.
Who crushed his union.
Well, right, but he's saying, look, free trade, that's his big concern. He wants free trade. He says the one thing that would really hurt us is if we back off of free trade.
That's such a vague statement, I just can't respond to it.
Well, I'm not quoting him directly there. He says, I have been very worried about a turn inward, a feeling we can sustain our standard of living by building walls around the country and blocking trade. Jim Owens, CEO of Caterpillar.
Okay, well, one thing that he also probably knows is that when every other trading partner around that we have around the world asks themselves, what's the market I've got to be in? What's the market I can't afford to miss if I'm going to be a world-class, you know, country or a world-class manufacturer? Where do I desperately need to sell? The answer, the honest answer, not the hype answer, is the United States. And the proof of that is that the U.S. is running about 65% of the world's total trade deficit.
But Americans don't mind them selling here as long as it works for everybody. I mean, we know they want to sell here. I think Americans know that very well.
They need to sell here.
Okay, so what?
Well, they need to sell here. However, the fact that our country's financial foundations are weakening so steadily means that our ability to pay for that consumption in responsible ways through our earnings rather than through piling up more and more debt is weakening as well. And if the U.S. consumer becomes tapped out, and we have to remember that he and she has been artificially propped up for a long, long time now by super low interest rates, by enormous federal budget deficits, et cetera. If the U.S. consumer becomes tapped out, and we're starting to see signs of this right now, the entire world economy is in deep trouble because we are the market that they have relied on overwhelmingly for their growth.
Let me go to the exporter. Tim Girton, when you look abroad, do you see barriers? Do you want more walls? Are you satisfied with U.S. trade policy or want a kind of revolution like Alan suggests?
Well, I think if we create barriers in the United States, people are going to respond by creating barriers elsewhere, and I know
they already exist.
Well, I know, but it affects our business whenever artificial barriers are created. It affects our ability to export. You know, it's not easy to compete in the world market. It is true that you do have to pay attention and you do have to work hard. People do try to sell their products in the United States, and sometimes those products are not bad. And so what we have to do is we have to be constantly on the move and constantly innovative. I think if you create good products and you fight really hard to keep at the leading edge of the market, then you can win internationally and you can win at the United States.
Andrew Bernard, we've just got half a minute left here. You started out bullish with us. You've heard the warnings here. Bring us back. Can we have manufacturing and exports and good wages in the future that we are headed into right now?
I think we can. I think that one of the biggest mistakes would be to try to isolate ourselves from the rest of the world. And the people that Mr. Tunnelson purports to be arguing for, the middle and lower income people, would be hurt the most because their products would increase the most in price. And the thing that I want to point out is that manufacturing is not going to resurge and be 25% of the U.S. economy and 30% of the workforce. I mean, that's not the image of the future. It's going to succeed. It's going to be about 15% of the output and probably a little bit lower in terms of employment. But the next round of projects and activities that we can't imagine will be high income and will keep the economy growing.
Well, our eyes are opened right here in a couple of directions and maybe more. Tim Girton, CEO of Varian Medical Systems in Palo Alto, California. Tim, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. I enjoyed it.
Great to have you. And Alan Tunnelson in Washington at the U.S. Business and Industry Council. Alan Tunnelson, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
Andrew Bernard of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth, thanks very much for being here.
That was my pleasure.
Listeners, great having you all. Hi to Peoria. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.